This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. How often do you think about your soap? Well, if you answered, not much, maybe you should. You see, a lot of what passes for soap in stores is technically not soap, according to the FDA's definition. It's full of lab-created chemicals and detergents because, well, it's cheaper to make. Now, what if you could buy natural soap made from natural ingredients like tallow, palm oil, coconut oil, and scented with essential oils, and for just a little more than you'd pay for grocery store soap? Sterling soap is 100% natural, and with a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne, there's a product and a scent for just about everybody. Check them out for yourself at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pig Pen, your portal to positive football history. And I have some great stories of football history for you today. I've been doing some vacationing, doing a little bit of reading, getting some great material to share with you. Some are appropriate for the day that we are releasing this story, which is May 30th, 2026. And it's about a player that was born on this day. Larry Kelly, a Yale football player born on May 30th, 1915, changed the course of football history with a controversial, quick-thinking play that left the Navy midshipman furious and the referees scrambling for the rulebook. It all happened October 17th, 1936 at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore, Maryland. Yale took on an undefeated Navy midshipman squad. Now, during this 1936 showdown between Yale and Navy, a loose ball bounced deep into midshipman territory. That's when Yale's end, Kelly, pursued the play as the ball trickled toward the Navy goal line. Realizing he could not scoop it up before the football rolled out of bounds, Kelly used his foot to boot the ball further downfield toward the end zone. Yale recovered the kicked fumble at the Navy 2-yard line, setting up the game-winning touchdown in a tight 12-7 victory. Now, this controversial play ignited a massive national debate regarding the legality of kicking a loose ball. Navy coaches and players protested fiercely, arguing that Kelly intentionally kicked the ball to advance it, a move that should have resulted in a penalty for an illegal kick. However, the officials in the game ruled that the contact was accidental and allowing the play to stand. The outcry from this specific instance forced the NCAA Football Rules Committee to alter the rulebook the following season, officially banning any intentional kicking of a loose ball, a regulation that was known for years as the Larry Kelly Rule. Instead of damaging his reputation, the high-profile debate showcased Kelly's uncanny knack for being in the right place at the right time. The media sensation surrounding his genius on-field awareness captivated voters. Just weeks after the Navy incident, Kelly became the first line player and the first player under the official Heisman name to win the coveted trophy. Larry Kelly proved that sometimes a little controversy is a perfect final touch on a Hall of Fame resume and a Heisman Trophy. For more deep dives into the rules that changed the gridiron forever, head over to PigskinDispatch.com. Heisman Trophy winning of Larry Kelly on our timeline on PigskinDispatch.com. Upper menu, there's a spot that says timeline. You can click on it. Two different timelines, one by every day of the year, which we've made famous here over the last 5 or 6 years. But now we have an annual, a yearly one that we're building out. Hope they have done by the beginning of September and football season start. But it's up through the late 1950s right now as we are recording this. You can go on PigskinDispatch.com. Timeline, go to yearly and find some great events that happened in the chronicles of football history. Yeah, I love those stories about old Yale football. Got to visit the Yale Bowl probably about 10, 15 years ago, and what a great nostalgic place to celebrate football, you know, being a fan of Walter Camp and everything that he did for the game. Just love walking those hallways, walking the grounds where legends played football and lived and went to school there on a campus of Yale University, Yale Bulldogs. But, you know, this is Fridays, and we're trying to reserve Fridays for some Pittsburgh Steelers-related stories. And we have a good one, you know, a couple good ones here. Really, the second one is going to be a little bit more. It's about Johnny Blood McNally, who ended up playing for the Steelers. We don't have too much Steeler stuff in it. But this next one is about the founder of the Steelers. So I told you not too long ago, as I do every year, I went up to the Western New York PFRA mini conference, get to see a bunch of old friends, hear some great speakers up there. But one of the great things they have up there is they have a book exchange for gridiron books, you know, things that you can read about. And I picked up one that in this little trade-off, the Fireside Book of Pro Football. It's edited by Richard Whittingham, and it is a group of multiple sports articles on the game of professional football, and they had some real dandies in there that a couple of them I'm going to reference here in this episode. And one of them is about Art Rooney Sr., you know, the chief, the glorified owner, original owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates, which turned into the Pittsburgh Steelers. A lot of stories that we've talked a lot about Art Rooney on past episodes. And one of the episodes is about his 1936 windfall that he made from horse racing. And I don't think that I had these numbers in hand when I talked about this before. We knew it was substantial enough to put the franchise that was sort of struggling, not winning a whole lot of games. Rooney wasn't a very wealthy man, but he was a gambler and he loved the horses, and he was friends with Tim Mara. Well, anyway, he's up in New York State for a weekend, and he didn't like to talk about it much, but this particular gentleman that's writing this article, wrote this article long ago, Roy Blount Jr., got to spend quite a bit of time with the chief and took a long car ride with him and a weekend of doing some gambling on some horses too. But he found out that in 1936, that Art Rooney Sr. had $300 in his pockets and went and played, at one Empire City racetrack up in New York State, ran up to $21,000 in one day by using his special formulas that he would do to put the horse numbers all together on that. Now, he went to a local watering hole, a sports bar at the time, and him and his cronies, and all of a sudden, three of them left there and went to Saratoga Racetrack, and he ended up taking that $21,000. He took $2,000 of it, bet an 8-1 on a horse that was named Quel Jeu. I'm not sure what the language that is or what it means, but it must mean you're going to win a lot of money, because this horse, it was 8-1, won the race, and so did several more during the day. And at the end of this day, he won $21,000 the day before. Well, he cleared $256,000, a cool quarter mil back in 1936. That's probably got a couple million by today's standards. Great day for Art Rooney, which helped him pay his payroll for his team for the 1936 season and beyond a few times. Got some decent players out of there. Didn't have a winning record very much, and didn't even win a playoff game until the Immaculate Reception game in the early 1970s. So just an amazing story, but it goes to show you a little bit of luck can go a long way, and Art Rooney definitely had it there. His horse racing helped his football team. You know, one player that played for Art Rooney Sr. back in the 1937 and 38 season, after playing multiple championships with the Green Bay Packers, some stops with the Duluth Eskimos, the Milwaukee Badgers, the Pottsville Maroons, a bunch of different plays. The vagabond halfback, Johnny Blood McNally, played for the Steelers 1937-1938, wore number 15 on his jersey. And here's a great story about Johnny Blood. Had another very memorable story that I got out of that, the Fireside Book of Pro Football that I got up at the PFRA book swap back in April. And this one was on Johnny Blood McNally. You can remember we've talked about Johnny Blood in a lot of instances. You know, he's known as the vagabond halfback. And one of the stories I got out of this little tale that came out of this Fireside Pro Football chat was from an article that was wrote. It was actually an interview back with Johnny Blood back in the day, And, you know, a lot of it was penned by himself, I believe, the way this article was written. And one reason is that he's called a vagabond halfback is that reporters were trying to come up with a name for him, because as a kid, he grew up in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area, and he used to hop a lot of trains. And sometimes to save a couple bucks when he was playing pro football, he would hop some trains to save a couple dollars to get to and fro and not have to pay his own fees for the train. So he would hop into boxcars and ride the rail. So a reporter found out about this and decided he was going to call him the hobo halfback. And Johnny McDally said, "Hey, don't call me that. That sounds kind of, disparaging. I don't want to have that be my name." So he said, "How about the vagabond halfback?" And that's the name they came up with. That's how Johnny McDally got that name. Now, as for Johnny Blood, we talked about it before. Kind of interesting, Johnny's own words were that him and another guy that played, they were on the freshman team at Notre Dame back in 1924. That's right, the Notre Dame team that had the four horsemen coached by Newt Rockne. Freshmen were not eligible in their first year of playing. So even though Johnny was practicing with the team with the four horsemen, he says the most famous thing, contribution that he did to that 1924 squad that ended up being crowned the national champions retroactively, was he used to write the English poetry papers for Harry Stuhldreher, one of the four horsemen. Kind of a funny thing there. But anyway, the way he got the name Johnny Blood, he told us, and we've said this story before, I think Warren Rogan told it one time, is that they were playing for Notre Dame. They did not want to lose their eligibility, but they wanted to put a little bit of cash in their pocket. So he and another player went and were playing some semi-pro ball. On their way there, they saw that there was a movie marquee that was called Blood and Sand was the name of the movie. I believe Valentino was the actor in it. And that's what they said. "Okay, that's going to be our names. I'll be Blood," said Johnny, "and you be Sand." And that's why the way they signed up their names to play in that semi-pro game and make some money under a pseudonym name so they wouldn't be recognized. But, Johnny Blood had some really cool things. He played not only on the Four Horsemen team under Newt Rockne. He practiced with them anyway. He ended up going and playing some minor teams up around the Minneapolis area. Played with the Milwaukee Badgers, who we've talked about in our book Marooned before. We know their story. He also played on the Duluth Eskimos with Ernie Nevers for a year or two. Loved Ernie Nevers, great player there. When the Eskimos folded up, he ended up playing for the Pottsville Maroons after the lost championship era, but he played with Pete Henry there, the famous Canton Bulldog and Pottsville Maroon. And then they ended up going and playing for Curly Lambeau with the Green Bay Packers and Cal Hubbard and a bunch of other great players, Arnie Erber and I think Don Hudson was coming on right about that, the end of his career at that time. But it's kind of funny that Curly Lambeau, I guess, didn't really care for Johnny Blood McNally. McNally, by his own admission, was quite the partier. He loved to go and have a few suds after the game, have some fun, live it up a little bit, chase the ladies around a little bit. Curly Lambeau, a lot more refined and conservative than that. Never was very fond of that, and a couple times they got into it where McNally thought he was off the team, and Lambeau would end up calling him up because he's just too talented of a player not to have on your team. He was, a great, very versatile running back that could catch a few passes in an era where the pass was just coming on with Arnie Erber and Hudson. It's very interesting that he fit Curly Lambeau's offense so well. But Lambeau personally didn't really like what Johnny Blood did, according to Johnny Blood McNally. So just a great little insight from Johnny Blood McNally himself on his own story. Well, we really want to thank you for joining us today with our great stories on football history. You can find more here just about three or four times a week on our podcast. We have multiple days where we're going on YouTube channel, a bunch of YouTube shorts. We have our visits with our friend Timothy P. Brown of footballarchaeology.com and some other guests. And always multiple articles, pigskindispatch.com, including our timeline and our games, Pigskin Trivia Drive, paper football, and more. Great things to do, football-oriented, and your portal to positive football history, pigskindispatch.com. Thanks for joining us, and have a great Gridiron Day.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network, and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.